Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And as the snow starts flickering down, yeah, we're going to turn our attention today to the South.
The South will rise again.
The South is...
Save your Confederate bills. The South will rise again. And certainly from a cooking standpoint, it is absolutely doing that. I mean, I guess places like New Orleans have always been known for their food, but now we have Atlanta and Charleston and Savannah and all kinds of southern spots.
Yeah, but the one of this.
But a common thread is the food. Sorry, love. Go ahead.
It's your turn.
No. It's not. It's your turn. I didn't know what you were going to say.
Oh, well, that's good. I'll surprise you saying that I think one of the most interesting books, vis-a-vis the subject of South, is from Chef Asha Gomez, when she talks about her two Souths, and she's talking about the South, and she's talking about South India.
And she's also talking about Atlanta.
Atlanta. That's her South. Asha Gomez.
Yes.
You had a brilliant idea, I'd say. You were born and raised in southern India.
And yes, I was.
And now you have a couple of restaurants in Atlanta, so you know the South of America.
And so, yes, I do.
Yeah, so you put these together with this fabulous concept, My Two Souths, blending the flavors of India into a southern kitchen. Now, is that what you do in your restaurants?
It is what I do in my restaurant. It just seemed like such a synergy. It happened very organically. I didn't have to put much thought into it. It just happened because every time I taste a dish here in the American South, somehow I would make a connection, you know, whether it was a Hop and John rice or it was something that had cane syrup because I grew up eating jaggery, or the fact that pork is such an abundantly celebrated meat here in the South.
Yes.
And pork is celebrated in the region where I come from. I just started finding all these similarities between these two regions, and, you know, connecting the dots became really easy for me.
But how did you get from Kerala, India, to Atlanta in the first place? I mean, these are not exactly two ends of a journey most people make.
No, they're not. So I migrated to the U.S. When I was 13 for the first time. Came here with our green card. I was raised Roman Catholic, and my father's brother was a Catholic priest in Michigan. And he sponsored us, and so we came here with our green cards when I was 13 years old. My parents enrolled my brothers in Michigan State for their engineering programs, and then they took me and went back home. And then 3 years later, when I was 16, I moved back to the U.S. permanently to go to college and, you know, live the American dream. So I've been here ever since. I'm 46 now.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, you outlined this in the introduction to your book.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've lived in the U.S. for 30 years. I've called the U.S. home a lot longer than I ever called India home. How I ended up in Atlanta is my then-husband got positioned in Atlanta at a law firm, and that's how we moved down south. And we've been here ever since. That was back in 2000.
Uh-huh. And you're enjoying it down there?
I love it. I love the South. I feel a certain kinship with it, similarities in climate, and the fact that I have access to all this amazing produce because of the fact that I live in the American South has been really, really amazing as a chef.
And well, the availability of produce has to be a big difference between Atlanta and Kerala.
Yes, but you know, we live in such a global market today. There isn't anything that I don't have access to. I mean, the furthest I have to go is Florida to get curry leaves and things like that. But you know, everything is so here. As far as ingredients that I need from Kerala, we have all these amazing Indian markets here in Atlanta. And so I really have access to everything at my fingertips. It's fascinating.
Yeah, no. your family had no problem with your becoming a chef, huh?
They did.
Okay, because the reason I ask is, you know, Gita Bansal of the Clay Oven,
yes.
Huh?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, she's a good friend. And she had problems with her family.
we are very education-oriented, and so I was like, what are you going to do? But it was just, you know, for me, the food world seemed to have been a natural progression of the trajectory that my life took. So today they really appreciate that this is what I do for a living.
Well, that's good. I don't think Gita's family ever came around to it. so you introduce all these different Indian ingredients into. Give us an example of how you do. I'm looking at this one: Southern style pork vindaloo with green bean varaka with cardamom cornbread. Now that is a blend, isn't it?
It is totally, you know, and I don't like the word fusion. To me, I didn't say that, did I?
I said blend.
No, you didn't. So I'm just like letting people know that it's just not something that, you know, it doesn't quite embody my cuisine. To me, my food is an evolution of who I am as a person, you know, as a cook, as a chef, as a mother, and the two places that I've been fortunate enough to call home. I grew up eating pork vindaloo, and then I come here and I see this amazing cornbread. And so I think the book is really about the introduction of spice into that southern pantry and southern kitchen or anywhere else in the U.S. where people can get a little bit more comfortable using spice with dishes that they're actually familiar with. I'm hoping that, you know, 20 years from now, when my son is in his kitchen making cardamom cornbread or biscuits with talisheri black pepper, it's not so out of the norm anymore. It's the it's immigrant chefs like me who have added to the landscape and have helped evolve this cuisine that we call Southern cuisine, because it's forever evolving. And I'm just a tiny little speck in that grand evolution.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, some of these, I mean, I'm really familiar with Southern food, and so some of these just, I found myself reading the recipe and grinning, because I just thought they were so clever. And it really cheered me up to see some of these things.
Oh, I'm so glad. That makes me happy to hear. Yeah. I think for me, it's the familiarity. You know, I would love for people to pick up the book and, you know, see something really familiar. At the same time, when they get into their kitchens and actually cook it, you know, there are all these nuanced flavors that come into these very classic Southern dishes. And it's exciting. I hope that, you know, people welcome it into their kitchens and are able to play a little bit with their spice cabinets.
Well, you know, apparently, I mean, you're much appreciated by, like I'm reading here, about John T. Edge's response to your food. Now, that's pretty heavy-duty stuff.
The John T. and the SFA have just been such great influences in my career. I was fortunate enough to cook at one of the symposiums. I made a tali with the country captain.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know if you know about that recipe, but Savannah Charlton claimed that recipe, and it dates back to the turn of the century. And the myth behind the recipe is that there was a British sailor who had obviously, a captain in the naval officers, had been to India on one of his tours and loved himself a curry chicken, finds himself in the American South and tries to replicate the curry chicken and does it with the ingredients that he has available. Uh-huh. And that is what country captain is, chicken country captain is. So for me, that dish, it just kind of takes me back full circle, you know, of bringing that dish back to its roots. That evolution is fascinating to me, and I think that's what caught John T's attention.
Yeah, well, he's really nice to have in your corner, I would say.
It's really funny. You're taking me back to some of my roots with vindaloo. When I was at Cambridge in the early 1960s, we'll admit to, we could sign out of dining hall twice a week, and twice a week we used to go to a restaurant called the New Bengal. and the New Bengal served both Italian and Indian food.
Wow.
And we would carbo load, but one of our favorites on the Indian menu was chicken vindaloo.
Yes, it's such a nuanced dish. So the story of the vindaloo recipe is when Portuguese traders used to travel, they would take chunks of meat and put it into wine barrels that spoiled and turned into vinegar, and it would preserve the meat for their journeys. And when they got to different shores, they would then add spices to it, and that's really how pork vindaloo came about. And it's such a nuanced dish, you know, this tang from the vinegar, this sweetness from sugar, this heat as much from garlic as there is from chili, because it's so garlic forward. And there's a tinge of bitterness that it is rounded out by mustard seeds. And so it's just such a nuanced, well-balanced, well-rounded dish. And it pairs so well with that cardamom cornbread.
Now, do you know Floyd Cardoz?
Yes, I do.
I love Floyd.
Well, he came to Pittsburgh to do a special event.
Oh, yeah.
He was the guest chef for a special event. I think it was Save Our Souls.
Save Our Strength.
Okay.
Save Our Strength. And he cooked a shrimp
recipe. Share Our Strength.
he cooked a shrimp recipe that came from Goa. And
He's from Goa.
Yeah, I understand. But here's how he explained it. He said for 3 months out of the year, when the wet monsoon is happening, you can't fish. I mean,
the water is churned up.
So you either can't because it's too frightening to go out, but also the water's all churned up, and there are lots of things in it that you probably wouldn't want to be exposed to anyway. So he cooked this dish. He said you cook this shrimp and you keep it for 3 months. So it's spiced such that it will keep...
It's pickled shrimp. We pickle a lot of seafood on the coastline.
Yeah, I see in your book you have a lot of... But, I mean, the one I can't...
I had a pickled catfish.
That's exactly what I'm looking at, and that stopped me in my tracks because I hate catfish.
And, you know, so I wasn't a big fan of catfish for the longest time, and then I ate in Sean Brock's restaurant and had the most delicious piece of catfish, and I was... changed forever.
Yeah, well, he's a great friend too. I like, you know, his cookies, great.
Yeah, so now it has become a very important part of my cuisine, catfish.
Yeah, what's that other fish I discovered in Charleston that I liked so much?
Sheep's head.
You know that one?
Oh, yes, I love sheep's head.
Yeah, I do too.
It's a tasty fish. Yes.
So your tradition is, I mean, India has a tradition of pickling as well then. And of course.
Very much so. And in the southern region, like you mentioned earlier, you know, in the month of the monsoon, the seas are too rough for you to go out to sea. So when you have an abundance of seafood, you dry the fish, you pickle the fish, and it takes you through those months where you can go to sea, so that it sustains you during those months. So pickling is really big for us, and especially the pickling of seafood.
Right. Now, what you said, that the discovery of catfish was a great revelation to you with Sean Brock. What other dishes were you, how about, like your tomato pie that you have?
Yes.
I mean, that is the most un-Indian concept, tomatoes, anyhow, right?
Yeah, so, you know, and that's the thing about this book. It's not really an Indian cookbook.
No.
It's an Indian sensibility in a southern kitchen. And then, of course, you know, my roots, I can't help it. There are some very classic dishes from my mother's kitchen that I've introduced into the book as well. So,
now what are those?
There is a Sunday beef stew that my mom used to make practically every Sunday. We came back from church after Mass, and it was a staple that's in the cookbook. My mother's fried chicken. I grew up eating fried chicken. People are shocked.
I am shocked.
They think it's an American thing. And I said, you know, I think every culture figured out that if you drenched a bird in flour and deep fried it, it was probably going to be good. So every culture has a fried bird. Some do it without, you know, the flour coating on it. Some do it with. In my mom's kitchen, it had a, you know, it was definitely coated with flour, but it's marinated in ginger, garlic, and buttermilk. And so I grew up eating fried chicken, but I served that fried chicken with a Low Country waffle. And then I said, you know, how do I marry these two things together? So I took cane syrup, and we spiced the cane syrup with coriander and chili flakes and cumin. And it just all came together so beautifully.
You really know your way around the kitchen. I'll tell you, I was impressed with these recipes. I'm even more impressed talking to you about it because you have a great rationale behind everything you do.
And, you know, our fried chicken, I mean, I couldn't take it out of my menu if I tried. I mean, we have people that love that fried chicken. We've been put on so many national lists for our fried chicken. So I'm excited that a lot of people get to bring it into their kitchens now.
Yeah, well, you give us another reason. We're trying to integrate turmeric into our diet as often as possible. And you have a turkey pot pie with turmeric.
Yes, you know.
It's so healthy, isn't it?
It is so healthy. In Indian cooking, if you notice, there's a pinch of turmeric in almost everything that we cook. The reason being, not so much necessarily for flavor as much as it is for its medicinal use. You know, it's a tremendous antiseptic and antibacterial agent. So we really did it very much as a precautionary ingredient. Uh-huh. And it's just so healthy.
It is.
So there's always a dash of turmeric in anything that we cook. And I still remember, you know, when I was younger and if I had a sore throat, my mom would warm up milk and put honey or sugar in it and then mix turmeric into it so that going down the throat, it would just kind of heal your sore throat. So instead of a lozenge,
we actually
drank turmeric milk.
We could try that. Peter has a cocktail with gin and turmeric. That might help with
the
cold too.
Delicious.
It
yes,
is great.
I'm sure it will.
It's called
a shot of brandy will do the trick.
Well, it's called a tumertini.
Nice.
Now, Asha, bring us up to date on, you've had so many different establishments and classes. And one, just give us what is current in terms of your...
Sure. I have I used to have a fine dining restaurant called Cardamom Hill.
Yes.
And I'm not a classically trained chef. I grew up in my mother's kitchen. I'm not a restaurateur. Kind of fell into this restaurant world and realized, oh my gosh, this is a rigorous life. And there's really no time for a work-life balance when you're in the kitchen. And so I made a very conscious decision of, you know, wanting to be a mom to my son as much as I wanted to be a chef. And so I closed Cardamom Hill and we opened a spot called Spice to Table. And it's a lunch-only spot, and it closes at 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm in the carpool lane by 2:45, picking
great.
Up my kid. And then I also have a space called the Third Space, which is a culinary kitchen. And I do a lot of dinners there, and I teach a lot of cooking classes there. A lot of production happens in the space. Because I had all... Now I have the time. I was able to write this book and have fun with the book. And I also love advocating for those less fortunate than us. I'm a huge proponent of making sure that at least in our lifetime we can eliminate hunger from our world. I don't think that in a world that's filled with so much abundance, anybody should go hungry
right.
to bed at night. And yet one out of every nine of us goes to bed hungry in the world. And so, you know, I walk in and out of congressional offices for causes that I believe in, whether it's the Global Food Security Act or it's the Farm Bill that deals with international food aid. And, you know, I've been able to find a nice balance in my life doing all the things that I enjoy doing.
Yeah, well, our friend Massimo Bottura, who has the number one restaurant in the world on that list, he believes that it's the absolute responsibility of every chef to work for that cause.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with him more.
Right. Well,
I think it absolutely is. It's beautifully put. You put it beautifully.
Well, he put it beautifully, and he's doing his bit, too.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow, it's a wonderful book. I really love meeting you, Asha Gomez, and say hello to Martha Hall-Foos, who worked with you on this book and writing the introduction.
She's a brilliant writer.
She's
brilliant.
She really is.
Really fun working with
her. She is fun as well. She's funny, has a good sense of humor, and you do, too. Again,
the book is
My Two Souths, and it's a great concept. The South of India and the South of the United States, but it's all the creativity and I'd say that the brain power of Chef Asha Gomez. Asha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be back with another story from the South coming back right after the break. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. There's been of late a great deal of interest in a section of the country I never would have even thought about in terms of food, called Appalachia. And it turns out everybody has a misconception of the geographical area and the culture of that particular expanse of
we've got it in here because a considerable amount of Appalachia is in what we would call the South.
Ronnie Lundy's South. Appalachia is south. I mean, her Appalachia is south.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, it's very interesting to
see. But her book has a very interesting title, which you have to struggle to pronounce.
Yeah.
Except I knew right away it's spelled victuals, but it's actually called
vittles.
And that's probably because it's attached to the south. And as most people know, if they think about it, the south was settled by people from my native land who certainly called their food vittles. And that tradition continues to this day.
Why did they spell it with a C?
That's a trap. It's a trap to me.
Trap.
It's a trap to so you can figure out whether someone's English or not, or how good their English is by whether or not they know how to pronounce the word properly, like many other words in the language. Anyway, time to do vittles with, what's the lady's name?
Ronnie Lundy.
Okay, Ronnie Lundy, here you go.
Ronnie Lundy, you were a very popular, nothing but rave reviews for your book, but here I'm going to make my first mistake. It's called Vittles, is that right?
Yes, it's called Vittles because that's the correct pronunciation of the word. It's spelled V-I-C-T-U-A-L-S. So that's a pretty interesting piece of information, I think, kind of surprising for people.
Yeah, I mean, I described it as vittles, as you say it's vittles with the D, and Peter was thinking victuals.
it's pronounced vittles in England too.
I see.
I mean, where do you think all these people from Kentucky came from to begin with?
Well, that's something we should talk about, actually.
Yeah.
That's a long and complicated story, but.
Well, I mean, let's get to the basis of this is, I think you're writing about the food ways of a really misunderstood part of the country. And we can talk about that. But Why don't you define geographically what the territory is of the Appalachian, and I probably do that wrong too,
No,
cuisine.
You did that correctly.
Oh, okay. Well, I got that one right. There is an Appalachian cuisine, right?
Yes, yes. So what I like to sort of, how I like to lay the literal ground here is to say that the Appalachian mountain range in North America extends from northern Alabama and northern Georgia all the way up into the Gaspé Peninsula of Canada. But when we commonly, popularly talk about Appalachia as a region, as a cultural region, what we tend to talk about is southern Appalachia and a little bit of central Appalachia. And that is what I talk about in terms of foodways in this book. And so it includes those parts of northern Alabama and Georgia and comes up into eastern Tennessee, western North Carolina, eastern Kentucky, the piece of southwestern Virginia that, being a Kentuckian, I say should always be Kentucky, and then the entire state of West Virginia, and a little bit into southern Ohio, and there's some commonalities in the foodways going into southwestern Pennsylvania and some of Maryland also. So but that is the region that we tend to talk about when we talk about Appalachian mountain people and music and crafts and stories and foods as well. So that was what I concentrated on in this book.
Now, people have all kinds of wrong opinions or pictures of the region. They see it as self-contained because of its mountainous, poor because it was poor.
Right.
But it conjures up, the word conjures up images of the Hollywood, what are these called? Hillbillies?
Beverly Hillbillies.
Right.
And I was raised to believe that that the culture was because of Elizabethan migrants that were isolated by the mountains, which gave way to odd habits of talking and food.
Well, we do have odd habits that come from other sources as well. It's very interesting because there are a whole story that is negative and derogatory, either humorously from the Beverly Hillbillies or darkly from movies like Deliverance. I've had friends say to me that they would be afraid to go into the mountains, and it breaks my heart.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Not only are they beautiful, but the people can be very welcoming, and it can be a very wonderful social interchange. And then there have been also these very romantic stories that we have been given as well, that we all lived off the land, that we made do with everything, that everyone was poor. And there certainly were people who were not invested with a lot of material goods and not interested in a lot of material goods. That has not been the primary interest in the region, as much as an interest in making connections with other people and making connections with the land and the earth. But among, you know, we start to have these myths that are based on a piece of fact. So a piece of fact is that the Ulster Irish, also called the Scotch Irish, were recruited to come into the Appalachian Mountains in the 1700s by East Coast entrepreneurs and speculators who wanted to encourage pioneers to come in to rid the region of its native inhabitants and to somewhat tame it so they could come in then after them and use the land for speculative purposes. And the Ulster Irish were a prominent group, but there were also, as you mentioned, there were people from England. And among the English, there were indentured servants, often people who had been arrested and put in jail for what we would consider, we would call crimes of poverty. Someone who hunted on land that his father had hunted on, but that had been since privatized by the baron who owned it. And so there were indentured servants, but there was also a good number of gentry who came from England. People from the moneyed class who were often second or third sons who did not stand to inherit as much in England, and they were offered, if you were a member of that moneyed class, you were offered not only the land that you could clear, which the poor immigrants were being offered, but you were offered 50 acres for every person that you brought with you.
Oh, wow.
So they often brought with them indentured servants. They also brought slaves because slavery, black slaves because slavery was happening in England, or they had slaves that they purchased when they came here. So they're a diverse part of the story. And in that original settlement, there are also Palatinate Germans, people from the Palatinate region of Germany, which was undergoing some religious persecution and some social shifting that was causing poverty there. And so this was a place where they could come and have a new start. And all of those things are really prevalent, along with a very strong Native American influence. There are these three European cultures from different classes, and then there is the African American influence in the foodways, in the earliest foodways. And then those foodways get changed as time goes on, because there are other immigrant groups who come in. There were Swiss immigrants who came to New York in the 1800s and were not able to find the promised land there. The jobs they'd been told would be there were not. It was very urban. It was very disturbing. And there were people who wanted, there were still, again, speculators who wanted workers to come in to work the lumber industry and the coal mining industry and to settle the back regions of the Appalachians. So they advertised for the Swiss. And there's still one existing Swiss community, Helvetia, but there were several others through the Appalachians. And then through the railroad and the logging, and of course the coal industry.
Yeah, that's what I think of all the time. But you point out that way before coal, it was a salt mining place.
Right. Well, the salt mines were the first extractive industry. I didn't even know this until I began researching the book. But salt was a major industry in Appalachia beginning in the late 1700s. And so people think of Appalachia as being extremely rural. And, in fact, it's had industrial development from the very earliest days. And there are cities that are part of Appalachia, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Asheville, North Carolina.
Which is where you live. You were born and raised in Kentucky, but you live in Asheville, right?
I live outside of Asheville. I actually do live farther up in the mountains in a small rural town that's about 40 minutes outside of Asheville.
Now, we've talked about one aspect of, if you like, the fabric of Appalachia, but there's another fabric that goes along with that, which is what was it that this population managed to find that they could plant and grow and eat?
Yes. So in the, about 5 or 6 years ago, Gary Nobin, who is a famous ethnobotanist, and Jim Vedito, who is another ethnobotanist, did research into, they did extensive research into what foods are available in the Appalachian Mountains, both foraged and hunted foods, but also the number and varieties of plants that are grown here by gardeners and farmers. And they were able to determine that central and southern Appalachia is the most diverse food shed in the United States.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that because I think of it as being difficult.
That word itself is interesting. Food shed. Is that sort of like the food equivalent of a watershed? Yeah. I'm a little bit puzzled because I never heard of the use of that term before.
Well, I think the food shed, I don't know the exact etymology of it. It's a term that's come into use frequently. And so I think what they mean is that it's a region that supplies food for its inhabitants and also has enough food that it became predominant in the culture to some extent. In Appalachia, you mentioned, Anne, that you think of this as difficult, and it is a very difficult terrain to farm. I found in interviewing people both about what they do presently in terms of planting and gardening particularly, but also small-scale farming, and what was done traditionally is that you had many plots on your piece of land. You didn't have just a garden. You would have, like, three or four gardens because there would only be so much land that was level enough and not rocky and had a good enough soil to begin with that you could plant there. And you would have another place that would have also a small patch, but maybe a different light from the sun. It would be in a different location, and so you planted other things there. So you had to have, it is difficult, and you had to have a very deep intelligence about the land and the seasons and the weather and the climate in order to grow food here. And that's one of the things that I like to point out when I'm talking about Appalachia, is that one of the myths that we hear is that we were very simple people, very ignorant. We didn't really know how to do anything but just plant some food and blah, blah, blah. But when you begin to look at the level of intelligence that it took for people to actually grow food and get food and forage food, the wisdom about what can be eaten in the woods is profound.
I was absolutely elated to realize that you had this wealth of morels, my favorite food.
Yes. Yes, we don't want to really let the word out that much.
Oh, yeah, nobody will tell you where their morel patches anyhow.
Well, hold on a second. Now, you also had hogs, though, right?
Yes, we did. The first hogs are actually brought in by the Spanish. People forget.
Yeah, they did.
They're the wild ones, right? They're the ones that went feral.
Right. And people forget that the Spanish were in Appalachia shortly after the Columbian excursion begins, Columbus's excursion begins. We have explorers all the way up into West Virginia and Kentucky in the 1500s. And it is a Spaniard who names Appalachia because they landed or they came into the Apalachicola Basin where the Apalachicola Indians were, which is on the Gulf of New Mexico, sort of in the part of the Florida Panhandle, And because they had met Apalachicola Indians there, they just named the whole region going up as Appalachia. The name Appalachia stuck for the mountains and the mountain region. And they brought in the wild hogs. And then, of course, when these European settlers come in, they're bringing in domesticated hogs. But one of the things that they learn very quickly about the region is that instead of penning up their swine, what they do is they turn the swine loose to forage themselves in this incredible forest that is filled with mast that is delicious, you know, acorns and chestnuts. And
yeah, that was what they do in Spain where they're
Exactly. And I one of the things I like to say is that the Appalachians are the belt buckle on the ham belt of the United States, that we produce the best hams, particularly people are going back to this kind of foraging method. And we don't have the ability to do those horrible industrial hog lots. We don't have that kind of space here. So we still produce some pretty amazing pork.
Now, looking through your book, I get this question coming up in my head all the time is, I know you were very active in the Southern Foodways Alliance. What distinguishes Appalachian cuisine from Southern cuisine in general? It seems to me to be the same ingredients.
That's a great question. And to a large extent, they work from the same larder. You're right. It's many of the same ingredients. What distinguishes Appalachian cuisine is that we have winter because of our and extreme winter. You know, we don't just have a cooler, damper season. We get snow, we get frost, we get ice. It can be very, very extreme. So we do not get the extra growing seasons that you can get in the South, depending upon where you are in the rest of the South. And this is because, not just because of our, it's because of our altitude and our latitude. We're higher, and it is also a part of the geography, the topography, which means that we had to devise ways of keeping food through the winter. So an example, since we were just talking about pigs, is this. Throughout the rest of the South, there is a huge tradition of barbecue where you take it, and that came from the concept of a pig picking, where a wealthy landowner or somebody who wanted to demonstrate their wealth would slaughter a hog and invite everyone to come on one day and eat the entire hog. And that is part of how the barbecue tradition is, how it's rooted in the rest of the South. In the Appalachian Mountains, we could not afford to kill a hog and eat it in one day. We had to kill a hog and salt down the hams and create bacon and smoke that. We had to make head cheese. We had to make sausages. There's a type of sausage that people do up here, which is it's called sock sausage, because traditionally you would stuff the sausage into a very clean, well-laundered sock and hang it in the smokehouse. But now people do. I know, and it's wonderful. What it does is it cures. So it has that sausage flavor, but it also gets that kind of fermented cheesy flavor. And then fermenting was the second thing that we did. I mentioned that there were German settlers and that they show up in our foodways. Sauerkraut is very beloved in the Appalachian South. We were able to do that in crocks long before there were canning methods that allowed you to put, you know, before there were ball jars. But we not only salted down and fermented cabbage, we fermented green beans. They're called pickle beans. And we fermented corn. When the Germans who were keen into fermenting arrived and were introduced to corn, they immediately decided to try to do that. And so those become winter foods. And they're not a condiment in the way that, say, kraut accompanies meat on the table. The pickle beans are the sour corn, and some people fermented them together. You would take out of the crock and drain, and depending upon your family's tolerance of saltiness, because they are very salty, you might rinse them or not, and you would melt bacon grease in a skillet, and you would put those vegetables in and season it with the bacon grease, get them warm, get them a little bit browned, give them a little additional umami kind of flavor, and that was a main course for your winter meal. It provided you with sustenance, the green beans. I talk a lot about mountain beans. Mountain beans.
Oh, yeah. What about those leather breeches, too?
Yes. So leather breeches are another piece of that story. You don't find leather breeches or shuck beans in other parts of the South. You find it only in the Appalachian Mountains and the Ozarks, and occasionally where somebody has moved away. But that was another means of taking the green beans from the garden before you could put them up in jars and can them. You would string them up on threads and put them up to dry, and then you would cook them in the heart of winter. You would basically dehydrate them and then simmer them a long time until the beans were softened and you could get all that protein from the beans. So those are things that are pretty distinctive to the Appalachian Mountains. And when you look at the, and also the prevalence of apples, there are in the part of western North Carolina where I am, there are somewhere between 700 to 1,000 different varieties of apples that have been identified. And you can grow apples deeper in the south, but fewer varieties because apples really need that snap of cold weather. Yeah, yeah. And we had that snap of cold weather, so we were a source of apples to the farther south. They were grown here not just for people to eat and turn into cider and to dry to make fried pies and stack cakes.
Oh, that's fine, yeah.
Yeah, people would take their apples and sell them in the plantation south because they didn't have them there. We also raised livestock in the era before the Civil War. Appalachians raised livestock that they then drove in huge masses down the Drovers Road into South Carolina and into the plantation south because plantation owners didn't want to turn that amount of property over to raising an animal just to eat. They wanted it to be part of their cash crop. So in the pre-Civil War times, Appalachia provided a lot of the meat to the plantation south.
Now, hold on just a second. Now we're talking here about history, but we're now in the 21st century, in the century of Walmart and Food Lion and other supermarket chains. How much of the traditional southern, if you know, Appalachian cuisine is still going on?
It's alive and thriving, she says.
It is alive and thriving. And I, you know, it's interesting that you're talking about supermarket chains. We have a chain in western North Carolina and east Tennessee and I think into southwest Virginia that is called Ingalls, the Ingalls Markets. And it is people who come to visit me in Burnsville, the town that I live in, marvel at my Ingalls Market because it's like going to, I would say it was like going to a Kroger store or, you know, one of those major chains, but they don't sell quite as many non-grocery items. But they're fully stocked grocery. I can find Thai food. I can find La Brea bread from San Francisco is shipped in and baked. It is a full-service market. I can also find in the produce section that when pole beans come in, which are the beans that are preferred in the Appalachian Mountains, and they are beans that have beans in them, not haricot vert or Blue Lake or the kind of beans that have been bred to not have beans and more resemble grass, there are bins of them at my supermarket, and they're designated as pole beans, and people buy them. There's also a green that we eat in the mountains that can be grown called land crafts, and they sell them at my supermarket too.
Okay, so it's really ongoing, and
yes.
People are getting ready to move to Tennessee.
Just for the food.
they better get a copy of this book so they can be ready when they get there.
I think that is a plan. Everyone should have a copy of that book to decide, right?
But, yeah, and the thing we haven't even touched on yet is when you get the book, you'll find the most enchanting characters that are prominent in this whole part of this country. And
yes.
And Ronnie profiles a whole bunch of them. So Ronnie Lundy, that's a great name, by the way. The book is Vittles, and it's an eye-opener, and the recipes are delicious as well. Thank you, Ronnie.
So much.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
This has been delightful. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com.
Well, here we are, and we're doing the South, and this is not specifically South, but really South. If you think of South, you think of what? You think of pigs, you think of hogs, you think of pork, you think of bacon. Give me bacon.
So there's this terrific.
Is that Garfield?
There's this terrific series of books called Savor the South, and wouldn't you know, of course, one of them, authored by a really fascinating gentleman called Fred
Thompson.
Thompson.
And he said he really
loves his bacon.
Put the pressure in to make sure he got the bacon subject in the series.
So you may be sure you're going to hear from a real expert and a real bacon lover. It's not every day that On the Menu can have a character for interview who has bumper stickers that say Fred Thompson for President. Welcome to the show, Fred Thompson. We just discovered that Fred, the Fred D. Thompson, who just wrote a singular book about bacon, which is the proximate cause of why we're interviewing him today, has a precisely exact namesake called Frederick D. Thompson, who was on Law and Order for many years, was a senator, I think, for a number of years, and decided at the last minute he was going to run for president. And he was successful in some of those things, but not in others, the last being one of those. But I was telling Fred the story of a time when I was on a flight from New York to Washington, D.C., and there was Fred D. Thompson trying to get a seat in first class, which I had, and I didn't give it to him.
Well, I don't blame you, but he probably he's much, much taller than I am, so he probably desperately wanted to seat in first class with his long legs.
He and I had
a lot of fun when I was working as a food stylist and photographer in Manhattan. I was listed in the phone book, and he was not. And I would get all kinds of calls. Offering me, could you come and speak to our lawyers group and we'll pay you $45,000 or $35,000 or whatever. And I always wondered what would happen if I said yes and showed up and did a cooking demonstration instead, if they would pay me.
That'd be very interesting. Anyway, as I mentioned a moment ago, the proximate cause of us inviting Fred to join us on today's program is the latest in the Southern
Savor the South.
Savor the South cookbook series.
Which is a fabulous series.
Yeah, fabulous series, and it's a one-word title like most of them are. It's bacon, and it's got three slices looking delightfully crisp on the cover. Now, do you really know how Savor the South sought you out to do this book?
I begged for this one.
Oh, you begged for it, okay. Now, you've done other ones,
right?
I finished
a book, Fred Thompson's Southern Sides, for Elaine Mazner, who was the creator of this series, Savor the South, and had really enjoyed working with UNC Press and knew that she was just starting. Matter of fact, when Savor the South came out, the first two, Tomatoes and Pecans, also came out at the same time.
Yeah, Marion Rubin did the tomatoes.
Yes, Marion's a dear and long friend of mine.
Yeah, me too. Us too.
Yes, I think the world of Marion.
Yeah, I do too.
She did a great job with tomatoes. And I immediately wanted to be a part of this Savor the South group of books. And there were a couple of things I was interested in working on, and bacon was one of them, because bacon is very near and dear to my heart and my family's heart and my Southern traditions. And so I literally begged until she said, sure, Fred, you can write bacon. And I said, okay.
I was
a happy boy.
Now, you were probably just trying to beat Jimmy Vilas, your old friend.
Jim and I go back a ways, too.
I'm sure you do.
Jim, when he came out with his series with his mom, Mother's Southern Kitchen, and I got to work with Jimmy and Martha Pearl, and Martha Pearl is a trip. I mean, it's, you know, I would highly encourage people to seek out Jimmy and his mother's books because they're just funny, but they also have great recipes. But yeah, I actually had several conversations with Jim Vilas because he had done a very long and involved book on bacon about 2 years ago. I think.
About which we interviewed him, by the way.
And we'll still
have it. But let's. There are several starting points we could make here, but I'm going to surprise Anne with a starting point that she probably doesn't even know he's coming. But it always puzzled me just a little bit. Now, you added to our conversation before we came on board that you are in the midst of an international trade deal between yourself and an acquaintance you met in Australia, because he says Australian bacon is rotten, and you're not so keen on American lamb. So I understand there's a major exchange of these ingredients taking place. I don't remember.
I had a delightful experience of meeting this gentleman from Australia who was visiting in the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill, North Carolina area, visiting his son and grandchildren. He came to a book signing that I had at Flyleaf Books, and he was talking about how he thought the bacon in Australia was awful, and that he actually, while he was in college, had learned to cure American bacon on his own. And I told him that I thought American lamb shanks were not as good as they could be. And so we have a deal now. I'm going to ship him American bacon. He's going to ship me Australian lamb shanks. So.
Well, now here's another twist on it, because I come from Europe originally, and I always thought the bacon in my home country was pretty good, but it was different. And there was one nation in Europe which built its entire economy, it seemed, practically on bacon, namely the country of Denmark. Which made really splendid bacon. But when I used to get bacon, usually my mother would want the full back, so I would have to get long back bacon, which had what I thought was what you call Canadian bacon at one end, and then streaky, as we called it, at the other end.
Streaky bacon at the other.
Help me with the definition here. In America, you don't see the meaty end, unless it's cut off as a different product altogether.
It's pretty much that part of it's usually reserved for roast and those kinds of things. Bacon in America, true bacon, is typically a pork belly cut. That doesn't mean that bacon can't be made out of the pork jowl, which it does. Happens a lot, called guanciale. But most of what Americans eat is pork belly bacon, which around the rest of the world, as you were making, is called sort of streaky bacon because it has streaks of lean meat, streaks of fat. And it's always cured and most of the time smoked. My first experience with bacon was an unsmoked bacon, just a cured bacon that my uncles and grandmother would do when they would kill hogs on their farm in Johnston County, North Carolina. And then they would, because they didn't have enough room in their smokehouse, they'd rather have the hams in there, and then they started smoking their bacon. And even that is, it's very different than commercial bacons.
But long back bacon is actually made from the other side?
Yes.
Okay, so it is actually from a totally different part of the animal.
Yes, sir.
The back as opposed to the bottom or the belly.
Yes, sir. Huh. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You learn a little something in this book, it's very educational.
If we're talking about the same part of the pig, we sort of call that fat back.
Fat back, okay. Fat back. All right.
And a lot of times fat back gets cured into salt pork, especially in the Northeast. Which they use for seasoning and cooking, and, you know, that's the basis for great clam chowder, is a good piece of salt pork. And in the South, fatback was also used for seasoning. We have a thing called stricoline, which some people have actually called white bacon, but that's not a real common term, which is a very streaky bacon, but it's
primarily fat,
and we use that. That does a lot for collard greens and other southern vegetables.
Well, you know, we were just in Rome, we were talking to a chef who had cooked in the United States, and the one thing that he really missed, he said, was bacon, because the Italians do pancetta, which mm-hmm. is not smoked, right?
Not smoked. It is a cured
but
bacon,
not smoked.
And I have a recipe for that in the book.
Yeah, I saw
pancetta.
That.
I like pancetta. I think pancetta has a very, very good uses for some things when you don't want that smoke flavor to come out, and it's a delightful product. But he's right. To try to find a piece of smoked pork in Italy, I visited the...
I never even thought of it, but he's... No. Yeah, I mean, I never thought of it at all. But, I mean, yeah. The other thing is, of course, in certain parts of northern Italy, you get lardo, which is altogether different. And
that goes back to our discussion of the stricoline and the fat back, because that's a lot of times what's used to make lardo. Is that fatty part.
So right. It's back or belly. I always get that confused.
Lardo is belly, right?
Lardo. Is it back or belly?
Yeah. So, you know, it's nice to know where it comes from on the pig, but the end result is, does it taste good? And then it doesn't really make any difference where it came from.
Right. Well, you know, very recently I learned about the expression high on the hog, which you mentioned in your book. But, I mean, the first time you mentioned it, you mentioned low on the hog, and I thought, aha, I wonder if he knows high on the hog. And, of course, you said that right next.
Well, now, hold on a second. Here's another one. It's interesting. I never even thought to ask this question before, and I don't think you address it in the book, but we talk about politics in America as pork barrel politics.
Oh, he does mention it.
Does he mention it? Yes. I must have missed it.
And he also mentioned scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all having to do with the rendered lard.
But the pork barrel association is what? What is that one, Ed?
Oh, right. Pork barrel? Yes. It's, you know, if you've got a full pork barrel, you're in pretty good shape.
See, that's all your lard stored in there.
But I thought there was sort of a degenerate, not degenerative, a term of abuse called pork barrel in the political era.
Yeah, but there.
Well, we have gotten to the point in the United States that there is a whole lot of pork barrel politics that goes on. It is a Southern term, and from what I can gather about the term, was used by what we used to call Southern Democrats, which are different than regular Democrats.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a way of their negotiating with their fellow colleagues in Congress to get additional money sent into the South, which was definitely needed, you know, during
Reconstruction.
Appeared after the Civil War and even, you know, through the next several decades.
To this day, in fact.
Well, there's a lot of pork barrel that goes to Maine now, too, and Alaska, and it goes all over. It's, you know, they've all, you know, like to use pork barrel in their political lives.
Well, no, let's get back to your book. I mean, you are an educator at heart, right?
I am. I want people to understand that being in the kitchen is a really beautiful experience. It's an educational experience for families, for children. It's a great place to teach children about fractions and things like that, and some biology.
Oh yeah!
But it's a great place to be, and I want people to understand that even through this period of where we've been inundated with processed food, that cooking is not difficult. That cooking is doing your own cooking is you're much better for it. Your health will be better. Your diet will be better. And you'll have more family experiences and more family time. And so that's kind of the core from where I come from. And when I write my columns for the News Observer here in Raleigh, or write for any of the magazines that I've written for, or write a book, it's about, I want you to feel like that you're sitting, that I'm sitting at your table in the kitchen, and I'm sort of helping you create this food product. And I want you to be comfortable with it.
Now you do some things with bacon that are a little surprising, though.
Oh, what, you don't like the bacon bourbon, huh?
Oh, bacon bourbon, yeah. But I like the idea of the bacon, bacon fat pie crust with apple pie.
I need to get this one in there. Ed, that's a terrible waste of good bourbon.
Well, now, if you go back and read the head notes, you'll notice.
You say that, yes.
Do not buy good bourbon for this.
No, you know? I understand.
Buy the bottom-of-the-shelf bourbon for that.
You have, like, things like bacon fat and mayo, mayonnaise, clarifying. It never even occurred to me to clarify bacon fat. But your recommendation for keeping it, boy, we don't follow that recommendation in storage. I mean, Peter hangs on to his bacon for weeks.
But it's in the refrigerator.
Doesn't matter. He says not to do that.
He says not to do that?
Right. Tell
well,
him.
Well, you should be using it faster than that.
I'm going to use a little bit tonight.
It will extend your shelf life. If you do refrigerate it, if you don't use a lot of bacon fat, if you do stick in the refrigerator.
You're right,
I had somebody ask me the other day, can you freeze bacon fat? And you certainly can. I kind of looked at that person and went, you need to know more about using your bacon fat if you're thinking you need to freeze it.
I used to freeze bacon just routinely. I mean, it takes some of the saltiness away, unfortunately, which is not a good thing, but... you're not even in favor of that, are you? Sliced bacon?
No, not particularly. The do-it-yourself, the DIY bacons in the front of the book, because you're buying a 4 to 5 pound pork belly, and that's a lot of bacon for anybody to consume, and of course you can also, you can share it with your neighbors, which will make them extremely happy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do routinely vacuum. I will cut the 4 to 5 pound slab into 1 pound slabs when I've cured it and smoked it. And then I use a vacuum pack machine, very simple $79 kind of.
Yeah, we have one of those.
Yeah, food saver thing. And I find that if you vacuum pack it and freeze it, that you do have some good life in the freezer for that.
With this food saver thing, I discovered something you should not use it on, which is bread.
I imagine that pretty much smushes it.
It does.
It's like a hockey puck when you finish.
Well, I'll tell you that you're not the only one that tried that. I tried to do vacuum packed biscuits one time, and I had biscuit pancakes.
But you do a variety of do-it-yourself bacons. You do the basic, you do maple infused, you do spicy chili bacon, which sounds really interesting. And then you do Canadian bacon, which is, not really the bacon you're talking about. And home-cured pancetta, which is certainly not the bacon you're talking about.
But the home cured pancetta is a lot of fun. I'll just tell you that.
Okay, well maybe we'll try that one. And then of course, these are all kind of classics. The cocktail stuff. You call them party worthy bacon, like the devils on horseback. And so I never thought of this bacon jam in a slow cooker though. That's ingenious.
Well, that is probably one of my favorite recipes in the book. And I'm going to go back to something Peter and I were talking about before we started our interview about a hamburger in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Peter, if you'll do your hamburger in Australia concept with the fried egg and put the bacon jam on there and then the fried egg, that is a thing of beauty.
Oh, I'm sure. It sounds wonderful.
You can take that bacon jam, you can stuff it in the middle of a meatloaf. I have a good friend who has a house down on the Pamlico River, and he does this thing called an onion bomb, where he takes a Vidalia onion, hollows it out, puts a ball of meat in the middle of it, and then totally wraps it around in bacon.
Oh, wow.
And I really ticked off at him because I didn't have that recipe, didn't know about that recipe before I wrote this book, or I would have included it. But I had some bacon jam when I was down there visiting him, and then we stuck bacon jam in the middle of that, and it was just unbelievably good. I mean, it's just wonderful stuff. And bacon jam, you can find a lot of different uses for it. I make a lot of grilled pizzas, spread that down.
Wow.
On pizza dough, with some fresh ricotta, some really great fresh mozzarella, some prosciutto over the top and some basil over the top of that, drizzle with olive oil, grill that off. It'd be one of the best pizzas you've ever had.
Well, Fred Thompson, I'm telling you, this book was making me hungry reading it. Now talking to you, I'm absolutely famished, and particularly for bacon. And the thing I like best about your book is that you say, despite all this silliness that's sprung up around bacon mania, the bacon will survive, and that makes me really thrilled.
Oh, I'm firmly convinced that it will survive. I mean, you know, that we've seen trends and fads, and, you know, I mean, bacon-scented Band-Aids, come on. But bacon, there are good uses for bacon other than the standard. If you haven't tried the bacon ice cream that's in the book, that is a gorgeous product. It's just, you know, with just enough bacon scent in it that you get that little bit of savory smoke in with the sweet. It's a wonderful combination. So, yes, that's part of maybe the bacon mania, but it's a good part of the bacon mania. And Peter, do not use good bourbon if you make the bourbon infused bacon
bourbon. I promise you won't.
Cheap stuff.
No pappy.
Anyway, Fred D. Thompson, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for your contribution to Save of the South Cookbook Series.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a delightful conversation. This is where I wish all interviews were.
Well, it's nice of you to say so. And next time you write a book in the series, you must give us a shout and join us once again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks, Fred. Have a good day.
You too. Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, thank you, Fred. What a great way to end the program. We'll be back same time, same place next week. We hope you will be too. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.